This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.
America is never wholly herself unless she is engaged in high moral principle. We as a people have such a purpose today. It is to make kinder the face of the nation and gentler the face of the world.
Nearly 30 years after his inaugural address in which he promised a kinder, gentler nation, former President George H.W. Bush died Friday at the age of 94. For the rest of the hour, we're going to look back on the life and legacy of the nation's 41st president. You can join the conversation. How do you remember the first President Bush, a formidable force in foreign policy, someone who failed to deliver on his domestic promises? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me here in the studio is presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, a professor of history at Rice University in Bush 41's adopted hometown of Houston, Texas. Douglas Brinkley, it's great to have you, and thanks so much for coming in person. It's great to meet you face to face.
Well, wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us from Austin, Texas is Mark Updegrove, president and CEO of the Lyndon Baines Johnson Foundation, presidential historian and author of the 2017 book, The Last Republican, Inside the Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Mark Updegrove, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Douglas, let me start with you. Just a really basic question. How are you remembering Bush 41?
Oh, I'm remembering what an incredible job he did on U.S. foreign policy. The fact of the matter is, you know, it was a dangerous time. We talk now about the Berlin Wall coming down, being torn down, but things could have, mayhem could have occurred. Bush very calmly dealt with the wall coming down. He dealt with German reunification. By 1991, we had the breakup of the Soviet Union. Everything was being unspooled and unraveling in the Balkans and the former Soviet republics. And he very calmly made sure that there was stability, that there was such a thing as a transatlantic alliance between the United States and the NATO countries. And he reassured Russia that they were going to be welcomed in the family of countries. And he did an amazing job of corralling loose nuclear weapons, keeping nuclear weapons out of rogue hands, which could have been very easy to have happened during those kind of hurly-burly years when the communism came to an end.
Mark, what I'd like to come to you with the same question. Douglas Brinkley there talking about Bush as a really sort of able steward of the post-Cold War era.
There's no question. I think that's the dominant part of his legacy. We had in place from 1989 to 1993 the right man, particularly given his diplomatic facility. He was the right person to be the leader of the free world during the breakup of the Soviet Union. He had those skills. It also is worth remembering, though, two other things. I think before he died, there was no American, perhaps no citizen of the world, who had seen more history firsthand than George H.W. Bush. He was on the front lines of World War II in Congress during the latter part of the LBJ years and building a great society. He was a special envoy to China before its opening, when China began its rise in the world. He was the head of the GOP during the Watergate years, and would go on to become the vice president during the Reagan years, of course, the president, and would ultimately become the president of the 43rd president of the United States, or excuse me, the father of the 43rd president of the United States. So I think that is an important part of his legacy, too, the amount of history he took part in. And finally, just being the patriarch of the Bush political dynasty, being, again, the father of the 43rd president, and perhaps the patriarch of a family that does so much more in the area of politics.
And I want to talk about sort of what happened to that Bush family dynasty. But I want to ask you both, and I'll come back to you, Douglas Brinkley. You know, much has been made of how he called for a kinder, gentler nation. But he was also capable of being a pretty tough partisan warrior. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But to what extent did he make good on that commitment to create a kinder, gentler nation? It certainly stands in stark contrast to the tone of the contemporary political discourse, I guess.
Well, Mark just gave us a great run through his resume and then also his character. He really did want it to be a kinder, gentler nation. However, he was a politician.
Yep.
And he was operating out of Harris County, Texas. He ran with the Republican Party when the South was very Democratic, eventually got traction. And in order to be a leader in the Republican Party, you've got to do some things that aren't kind and aren't gentle. We see that most famously with the hiring of Lee Atwater in the campaign in 1988 against Michael Dukakis. And although I think for the rest of his life, 41 was embarrassed by the Willie Horton ad and said it came from a farm organization. It's not from home base.
And let me just jump in because I just want to remind for listeners who might not recall or might not know, the Willie Horton ad was a really tough political ad that tried to link Michael Dukakis, who was running for president against George H.W. Bush, to link him to Willie Horton, who was a furloughed black man who was involved in a murder, and the case was basically to create a lot of fear around programs like this and tar Michael Dukakis, right?
Exactly, and yeah. Some saw it as a racist ad,
yep.
And that's not the brand that we remember 41 for. He wants to be remembered as somebody who did care about affirmative action, who did give African Americans top positions. The first black Surgeon General came from 41. He worked with Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice. He picked Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, which should have been a big moment, a new Thurgood Marshall coming to the Supreme Court, except Clarence Thomas blew up on him because of the Anita Hill and sexual harassment allegations and the fact that many Americans, even some centrist Republicans, thought that Clarence Thompson was too much of a right-wing ideologue. The point is, you can't come out of politics without having some sharp elbows.
Right.
But what tells you about his character, in my mind, is when he loses, when he lost to Bill Clinton in 1992, how gracious he was to Bill Clinton, not just the famous note he left behind, but his concession speech and the fact that in later years he was able to work on, you know, Katrina relief and other humanitarian causes with the young whippersnapper from Arkansas who beat him.
Yeah.
I think that speaks largely to what a marvelous character he had.
Let's go to Bruce, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Bruce, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
You're welcome. I guess I feel quite different than Professor Brinkley about the Willie Horton ad, and sort of it really sort of seared my consciousness at how that ad stoked racial fears by using white supremacist strategies, playing on these age-old, long-created notions, as the professor would know, about black men as criminals.
No, I'm agreement with you. That's what I was agreeing with.
Let me finish, professor. Yeah.
No, but you can finish, Bruce, but I do want to say that that's exactly what Professor Brinkley was expressing, was concern about that ad. But go ahead and finish your point.
You're missing my point. Let me finish my point for sure, because what I'm saying is that's what stuck. And that's what sticks. And all that you're talking about in terms of his character and his thousand points of lights and a kinder, gentler nation was trumped, if you will, by that ad, which Republicans have played upon and continue to play upon, thinking about Trump's obvious racist caricatures, playing on that ad with Luis Bracamontes, for example, about the California deputies. That was horrifying that they keep playing the same card. That started with Willie Horton and long before, I should add, as the professor of history knows, and that's what sticks and that's what's significant in my view.
Well, Bruce, thanks so much for the call. Douglas Brinkley, respond to that.
As I said, I have a lot of concern about that Willie Horton ad. I think it was racist. And I think Lee Atwater ran a very dirty campaign. When you talk about dark moments in presidential history, I put the Willie Horton ad very high. We saw in the midterms here President Trump doing that caravan ad and dealing with, you know, another different kind of racist ad about somebody from Latin American, being a bully and murdering people and put it in. And even Fox News pulled that. So I think that we don't, when somebody dies, we just don't want to talk about the high points. We want to remember things that they did badly. And I think that Willie Horton ad is the low ebb. ebb of Bush's life.
You know, Mark Updegrove, I'd love to get you to comment on this, but I'll just sort of preface the question by I was reading quotes from Michael Dukakis, who sort of said, you know, obviously I had some significant differences with George H.W. Bush, but he called him a very wise and thoughtful man. But chime in on this conversation about the significance of that Willie Horton ad, I guess, and what it ushered in terms of political warfare.
Yeah, I think Doug articulated it very well, and he mentioned the sharp elbows of politics. And in talking with George Bush, he often invoked that phrase. He would say, when you're in the heat of battle, the elbows get sharp. And you can see in his remarkable career, him toggle back between political expedience and kind of fighting with his conscience to do the right thing. And a great example of that, as it relates to race, goes back to his days in the 1960s when he was running for the Senate unsuccessfully and for Congress successfully. In 1964, he campaigns for the Senate against Ralph Yarborough, the incumbent senator here in Texas, and he ultimately loses, but he comes out against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And he does so because he knows it's the right thing to do for constituents. He knows that it's profoundly unpopular in Texas. And so he exploits that vote from Ralph Yarborough. But he goes on to become a congressman. And in 1968, when Martin Luther King is assassinated, the Fair Housing Act is proposed, and he has to vote on that. It's wildly unpopular, like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was, but he supports it, as a matter of conscience. Huh. And he does so at his political peril. Comes back to Houston and talks to a very angry room full of constituents in a high school gymnasium. And he starts talking about why he has made that vote, has supported the Fair Housing Act as an act of conscience. And he ends up getting a standing, standing ovation from the crowd. And it sort of is the political education of George Herbert Walker Bush. He would still have struggles between what was the right thing to do politically and the right thing to do as a matter of conscience. But I really do believe that the very fact that he was talking about high moral principle and thinking about it throughout the course of his career speaks volumes about George Herbert Walker Bush.
I was looking and really impressed by a piece this morning in the New York Times by John Meacham. He wrote Destiny of Power, The American Odyssey of George H.W. Bush. And he describes this meeting between Bush and Newt Gingrich right after Newt Gingrich came to Congress. And Bush, in conversation with Gingrich, finally says, you know, I'm worried that your idealism will get in the way of what I think is sound governance. And that seems to sum up so much Bush's view of governing and how it would lose out to Gingrich's style of sort of partisan combat and warfare, which in a way has stuck with us ever since. What do you think, Douglas?
Well, Newt Gingrich's famous contract, you know, with America's 1994, and Bush lost in 1992. So Gingrich is saying to Bush also, you have a losing strategy. What was the problems that Bush faced in 92? Was it Bill Clinton only? No. He was attacked by Pat Buchanan from the far right, that Bush was not taking the cultural issues of America seriously enough. It was sort of a pitchfork campaign by Buchanan against Bush. And then Ross Perot, the Texas billionaire, runs a third-party campaign, anti-NAFTA campaign. The sucking sound you hear of the jobs going to Mexico. And so by 92, 3, 4, when you're looking at who George Herbert Walker Bush is, he represents the center, maybe slightly center-right of the America's Republican Party, but the party's moving away from him. They're seeing Bushism as failure, and that the new – you have to out-Reagan. And that's what Newt Gingrich tries to do. And then you see George W. Bush, the son, try to be more Reagan-esque than like his own father.
Mark Updegrove, he was the last World War II generation president. How did that link to that moment in history shape his worldview and his record as president?
Yeah, John F. Kennedy came in proclaiming that the torch had been passed to a new generation of Americans, and it would stay with that generation, what we now call the greatest generation from 1961, of Kennedy's presidency through George H.W. Bush's presidency in 1993. You know, he was shot down in World War II in the Pacific Theater. He was a naval aviator, and his plane went down off of the island of Chichijima. He lost two crewmates as the plane crashed into the Pacific. And he was on a raft paddling furiously away from the island where he would have been captured and probably killed. And out of nowhere comes the USS Finback, a submarine, a U.S. submarine, which picks him up. It's absolutely miraculous. And he thought that day and throughout the life, the course of his remarkable life, that his life that day was spared. And there was some kind of destiny that awaited him. And I don't think he ever took life for granted or his role in the world for granted after that. He always put service above self. And I think that that incident in the Pacific Theater shaped him as much as any in his life.
Well, Mark Updegrove, the head of the LBJ Foundation in Austin, Texas, and author of the 2017 book, The Last Republicans, Inside the Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. We appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian and professor of history at Rice University. Thank you, Douglas Brinkley, for coming in and helping us to remember former President George H.W. Bush, who died this past Friday at the age of 94. Douglas, thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.